Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, you already know the Valley's polluted air is bad for your lungs, but what if that same pollution also compromised your immune system and even caused changes at the genetic level? FM89's Rebecca Plevin reports on groundbreaking new research that's taking place in Fresno that could change the way we think about the health effects of air pollution. We'll also hear how librarians in rural Tulare County are using vending machines to bring books to communities without libraries. And finally, David Moss Masumoto joins us to talk about the 75th anniversary of Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath and an event celebrating the book taking place tomorrow in Bakersfield. Those stories and much more all coming up on Valley Edition. But first, the news.
With these news headlines, I'm Ezra David Romero. There are some new numbers out today on how well California school students are reading, and the numbers aren't good. Katie Orr reports from Sacramento.
Nearly 75% of California fourth graders are reading below their grade level, and the achievement gap between low and higher income students is growing. A new report out from the Annie E. Casey Foundation and the advocacy group Children Now finds only three states and the District of Columbia fare worse than California. Children Now President Ted Lempert attributes California's poor scores to low levels of per-pupil spending, but he says the state's new school funding plan could help.
I think the new funding formula that directs money specifically to low-income students and English learners will help close that gap. So it's definitely a very positive step forward, but clearly more needs to be done.
The study found 85% of low-income fourth graders in California are reading below grade level. That's compared to 54% of higher-income students. At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
A bill in the California legislature would prohibit people from claiming that their privileged backgrounds made them unable to distinguish right from wrong. From Sacramento, Max Pringle reports.
In a case that sparked outrage, a defense psychologist last year convinced a Texas judge that a teenage drunk driver who killed four people should get probation instead of prison time because he had an overly indulgent upbringing. Democratic Assemblyman Mike Gatto says his bill would even the playing field for sentencing in cases like this.
The wealthy will always be able to afford better lawyers, but there are certain things we can change. The laws can be made to knock out some of these defenses that are a little hard for us to believe.
If the bill passes, it would make California the first state to ban the so-called affluenza court defense. The Assembly Rules Committee has passed the bill on to the Public Safety Committee. At the state capitol, I'm Max Pringle.
It's the middle of winter, but you wouldn't know it based on the number of wildfires in California. Katie Orr reports from Sacramento on what fire agencies are asking the public to do to help protect the state.
CAL FIRE says it's already responded to 300 wildfires this year, up from the 50 that would be normal for this time in a typical year. Now the agency is asking landowners to clear defensible space around homes months before they normally would. Dave Zaski with the North Tahoe Fire Department says people need to be extra careful to avoid causing fires.
You know, we can't do anything about lightning, but the most damaging fires are human-caused, like the Rim Fire, where they had a campground fire when they shouldn't have had.
Zaski says the region has already seen a wildland fire on the Nevada side of the lake. He says that's unusual because the fire was at an elevation of 7,000 feet. At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
This is Valley Public Radio News.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. As California's record-setting drought continues to drag on, it's not just the lack of water that's a big concern. It's also the spike in air pollution. Of course, pollution here is nothing new for the residents of the San Joaquin Valley, but new research, done in part in Fresno, suggests that we might need to rethink the impact air pollution has on human health. FM89's Rebecca Plevin explains.
Here in the Central Valley, in one of the most polluted air basins in the country, we know that poor air is bad for our health. We feel it in our eyes and throat, and when we struggle to breathe. But what if air pollution is affecting us at a deeper, cellular level? That's exactly what Dr. Kari Nadeau discovered a few years ago. She's a Stanford School of Medicine professor with an expertise in asthma and allergies. She noticed that many of her child asthma patients had abnormally low levels of regulatory T cells, which are crucial to maintaining a healthy immune system. Then she noticed something interesting.
I looked at ages, I looked at ethnicities, and then I looked at addresses. And lo and behold, the addresses were all in one area of the country.
Fresno, to be exact. Nadeau then compared the regulatory T cell function in kids from Fresno, where there's heavy air pollution, with kids from Palo Alto, where there's less air pollution. They focused specifically on exposure to one of the byproducts of combustion. PAH, as it's known by its initials, is made from gasoline and diesel engines and burning of wood and tobacco. The results were surprising. She found that even kids without asthma in Fresno had lower regulatory T cell levels, meaning reduced immune system function, than kids in Palo Alto with asthma. The children's immune function was measured by studying a gene known as FOXP3. In Fresno kids, this gene was also more suppressed than the Palo Alto kids. That means, she concluded, that exposure to the pollution was possibly causing changes to kids' DNA. That finding surprised Dr. Catherine Hammond, a UC Berkeley professor and a longtime air pollution researcher.
I have to say my jaw dropped about almost to the floor. I was stunned.
Hammond says that even for a small study, there was a clear and direct link between air pollution and kids' immune systems.
So the more PAH exposure that they had, the worse their T regulatory cell functions were. And then to find out that you could go deeper into the cellular level and find that, oh my golly, the air pollution relates to the degree to which there's been a change in their genes.
Nadeau's results raised more questions for researchers like Hammond. They began to wonder if air pollution's effect on the immune system could lead to other health problems far beyond asthma.
It's very clear air pollution is playing a major role in the health of people in Fresno and in surrounding counties. But at the same time, I think that we have only begun to understand the full extent of that.
Researchers from Stanford and UC Berkeley, including Nadeau and Hammond, could soon uncover some answers. They've received a major 5-year grant from the US EPA and NIH to study children's health and air pollution in the Valley. It's one of about a dozen children's environmental health centers across the country. The researchers will study whether exposure to the air pollutant PAH increases the risk of birth defects. Following up on Nadeau's research, they'll also investigate whether the T regulatory cell and the air pollutant play a role in children's risk of allergic disorders, diabetes, and obesity. Wait, obesity?
I was like a little surprised that that could be related. But in fact, there is a very clear path through which that might happen.
Is that because the foul air deters kids from playing outside? Nope, that's not why, says Dr. John Balmes. He's a physician at UCSF and UC Berkeley, who's leading the center's research into air pollution and obesity. He says the air pollutant can injure the lining of the lungs and cause inflammation.
If that airway inflammation is severe enough, it spills over into the circulation, so you have systemic inflammation. And we know that systemic inflammation leads to increased risk of both diabetes and obesity.
As part of the study, the UCSF Fresno team will take blood samples, which will be analyzed at Stanford. They will also test kids' lung function and measure their height, weight, and body fat. If their hypotheses are correct, the researchers' work could fundamentally shift the way we view air pollution as a health threat. Fresno State professor Dr. John Kappenman is leading one of the research projects. He says the idea that a polluted environment could not only affect the lungs and heart, but also change people's underlying genetics and cell formation is mind-boggling.
One kind of implication of this kind of study is we can really show this idea of epigenetic changes, changes in people's genetic makeup from their exposure to the environment. And those epigenetic changes potentially go on not only through their life, but actually get passed on to their children to the second and third generation.
The Children's Environmental Health Center has funding through 2018. The researchers expect to have some early results in 2 to 3 years. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
You're listening to Valley Edition. The last 7 days have been significant ones for local ice hockey fans, and not just on the ice, but rather off the ice. Last week, the Bakersfield Condors of the minor league ECHL announced that the team has been acquired by the NHL's Edmonton Oilers. Fans and local officials hope the change will give a boost to the popular franchise in many ways. And further up Highway 99, the city of Fresno is in discussions with a Bay Area developer who has plans to bring another ECHL franchise to the city, which has been without a team since the Fresno Falcons folded operations in 2008. The team would take the place of the San Francisco Bulls, which ceased operations just yesterday after financial problems. The plan has sparked a lot of discussion among watchers at City Hall, and the lease agreement between the city and the owners of the team is a point of contention. We'll talk about that and much more in a moment. Here to talk about this story of two hockey cities, we're joined on the phone by Mike Griffith, a sports writer with the Bakersfield Californian. Mike, welcome.
Thank you.
And also joining us in our studio today, we have Marek Warzowski with the Fresno Bee, who's been covering this story on the Fresno side. Marek, welcome.
Nice to be here, Joe.
Mike, I want to talk with you since the purchase of the Condors was so much in the news last week. Is it unusual for an NHL team to come in and acquire the essentially AA minor league franchise, as we saw last week with the Condors?
Well, I think so. We could say that the Kings kind of own Ontario Reign. They own a piece. AEG owns the majority, I understand. But AEG basically owns the Kings. So they kind of have the Ontario Reign, not wholly on paper, but the only other team I can think of in the ECHL that was owned by an NHL team was the Trenton, New Jersey. The New Jersey Devils bought that, I think, in around 07, 06. Ran for about 4 years, and then they sold. It wasn't real successful. Kind of a problem there, and Trenton is a Philadelphia fans.
Yeah,
not
I can see.
New Jersey Devil fans, so it's hard to make Flyers fans goes to Devils games.
So by all accounts, the Condors have been a successful minor league franchise. Edmonton has its own challenges at the NHL level, but why do you think the owners of the Oilers came into Bakersfield and wanted to make this move right now? And what does it do for them, and what does it do for the city?
Well, I think they may have been looking at Stockton, where they were affiliated for, I think, 5-6 years. Ended that affiliation this year, but I think a lot of things may be in that factor. Then basically the Stockton president left, most of the front office left, the coaching staff left, moved on. So it was a whole new rebuild. And then the city's bankrupt, and the Edmonton Oilers president didn't dance around that. He said that's a big reason why Bakersfield is not bankrupt. So I think they're looking for a development chain, much like Major League Baseball. Hockey does not have that, and maybe they can get some players down at this lower level, stick around a year or two, give them a little extra time, and if they miss some late bloomers, maybe they start here.
And again, I guess Bakersfield would give that stability that the NHL team would like. I want to bring Marek Warzowski from the Fresno Bee into the conversation now and talk about this tale of two cities. Fresno and Bakersfield, not all that dissimilar, not very far apart. Just a couple hours away on Highway 99, yet the story of minor league hockey in these two cities has been dramatically different. Marek, your thoughts on why Fresno and Bakersfield have seen their paths go different ways. A few years ago, both cities had thriving teams back in the early 2000s, but that changed in 2008 in Fresno.
Well, I think it was due to kind of a shuffling of arenas and also a change of ownership. You know, the Fresno Falcons had, for decades, they were in Selling Arena. Save Mart Center got built. It was a $100 million building, spiffy, brand new, and it was, you can see why they wanted to come up there and play. It didn't really work out as well as maybe they had hoped. There was also an ownership change, in that 5-year run at Selland Arena. And the perception is, at least, that those owners, weren't as on board with hockey as maybe the previous ones were. And so when the city of Fresno, they basically outbid Save Mart Center to get the Falcons back downtown, and that collapsed, just a couple months into the first season back.
And the city took out quite a bit of financing to make the needed improvements at the 40-plus-year-old Celland Arena. They put in new ice. They put in new scoreboards and things. And then within a few games, the team was out of business. I guess not all that dissimilar from what Mike was talking about happened in Stockton with the new arena that that city built and that led in with many other things to
these
that
ECL
city's
franchises.
Financial problems.
I mean, they, you know, as we saw with the Bulls, we've seen with a couple of other teams over the years. I think it was an Augusta team that folded the same year as the Falcons did. And you know, we see that they're not always all that stable.
Yeah. Well, Mike, what has been the key to the Bakersfield Condors' success, do you think?
Oh, I think part of it, Fresno's a big Division One college town. It's all about the Bulldogs there, drives a lot of the media. The Save Mart situation, rent was high, building was too big, dates weren't that good because of obviously Fresno teams, including volleyball, whatever, get first dibs on dates, meaning weekend dates most of the time. So it's a tough sell there in Fresno for a variety of reasons, I think. In Bakersfield, you got CSUB here as Division II for a long time, now fledging Division I. But the Condors have been able to build a brand and work hard. They've got a big front office staff, started with a big front office staff, and they realize they're selling entertainment, not just hockey. I think that's a key. As Mark said, there's a lot of teams have gone. I think since Jonathan Fleisig, who just sold the Condors, since he became the owner, there's been, well, now 10 West Coast ECHL teams that have come or just gone in 16 years. So that shows that it's pretty hard to keep a franchise going. It's a costly business. You better be prepared to lose some money, and I don't think you want to lose too much. I never thought San Francisco was viable from the get-go. Major League City, if you've ever been to the Cal Palace, well, it's historic, kind of like Salmon Ballpark here. At this level, you have to pay for the players' housing, and that's a huge cost. And in San Francisco, I just could never imagine it penciling out.
Again, turning to Mark Warzowski of the Fresno Bee, Mike Griffiths is also with us on the phone from the Bakersfield, California. Mark, I want to get into the details of this deal or potential deal because it's very, very murky right now and very much a question mark. But about the fan base for hockey here in Central California, what have you heard? You've had several articles in the Bee over the last week talking about this deal and talking about the potential for a team coming back to Fresno. Is there a fan base? Are you hearing an overwhelming number of hockey fans contacting you, or is it kind of lukewarm at this point? We've been over 4 years since
I'm actually hockey. Surprised by the number of emails and phone calls that I've gotten about hockey and from hockey fans. That is a little bit surprising to me. You know, it's not maybe on the level of, you know, Fresno State football when I write something they don't like, but I have gotten a lot of response from the hockey community and people from Visalia and even Tulare and up in Madera and Fresno. And there are people who miss the Falcons out there. I mean, and they kind of feel like the team was taken away from them wrongly. That's their feeling, at least. And, you know, and I've heard from those people, and they want hockey back. And whether it's an overwhelming number of people, it's hard for me to kind of tell. But, as far as articles go, this has gotten some response.
You know, I talk to a lot of hockey fans, and they used to go to the Falcons games when they were originally at Celland Arena. Then they moved to Save Mart Center. And I hear people say, you know, it wasn't the same when they moved to Save Mart Center. And then they never were around long enough in the second iteration of Falcons 2.0 downtown. Was there something about that original hockey, original Falcons team when it was at Celland Arena that was different? They had a very, not a huge fan base, but a very dedicated fan base.
Well, they drew the last 3 years before the move to Save Mart, they drew over 5,200 fans all three of those years. Now, anything at Save Mart is different than Celland. It's just a different atmosphere. Frankly, Save Mart Center is a better hockey arena than it is a basketball arena. That is what it was designed for. You know, it really is not designed as a basketball arena. It's a multi-purpose arena, and hockey is really is better for that. But of course, when you get, 4,000 or 5,000 people in a 15,000 seat building, it just doesn't feel the same. At Celland, 4,000 or 5,000 people can feel like a good atmosphere. And that's frankly, it's the same thing that Fresno State basketball is experiencing right now. So, yeah, the move to Save Mart, I mean, that was ill-fated, although at the time you could understand it because Celland hadn't been improved yet and Save Mart was the brand new building on the block. So I can't blame anybody for wanting to move there.
So the city owns this aging arena that they just put a lot of money in 2008, and they're still paying off the bonds. They're going to be paying off the bonds for years and years to come. It doesn't have a permanent tenant. The city is booking some concerts there, and now this developer who is in talks with the ECHL and has a plan to acquire the franchise rights for the former San Francisco team. And he says he's looking at Oakland or Fresno, or maybe some other city. Tell us about this gentleman who's this investor and what's his vision.
Well, his name is David Bukuyan. There's a Q in there, so it's kind of hard to pronounce. But he is a pretty well-known real estate developer in the Bay Area. He's a big hockey fan. You know, he's put together a group of other developers just like himself that are interested in hockey and want to, and some of these folks he's told me have owned minor league franchises in the past. I don't think he's looking for a quick fix. He's looking for a permanent home for this kind of Bulls hockey team. I don't believe it's something he's going to rush into. The names that were originally floated were Fresno and Oakland, but Oakland, it would depend. The only place, my understanding is, the only place to play there is Oracle Arena, and they'd have to get the agreement of the Golden State Warriors to do
that.
Not
likely.
And that's considered a long shot. So he did set his sights to Fresno. He called around here. You know, the only two places in town that we've talked about, Save Mart and Celland. So he has obviously figured out that Celland is the place that makes the most sense, and he has sent a proposal, you know, to city officials to try to get this team. And I sense they're kind of lukewarm on it, at least the initial proposal that we've been able to ferret out. I don't believe there's been a whole bunch of negotiating as of yet. And also, last week was a deadline for the ECHL to cement its schedule for the 2014-2015 season. So as of right now, the Bulls, you know, they ceased operations, and my understanding is there will not be a team next season either. So if this Bulls team moves to another city, it would be for 2015-2016. And David Bukuyan, he says that's fine with him. He would love to – he doesn't want a quick fix. He's looking for a permanent home. So for him to come in a year early and get to know people and start marketing and build up interest – for, you know, 2015-2016 is fine with him.
Do we know if he's talked at all with the folks at SMG for Fresno State who run the Save Mart?
Well, I believe he has. I mean, SMG runs both those
arenas.
Operations. He did speak with folks at the Save Mart Center. Save Mart Center right now is not equipped to handle hockey. They do not even own a Zamboni machine. They sold it to the city of Fresno. So they've got the boards, they've got ice capabilities, but they are lacking some things. So they could not host hockey currently. But Celland could. They've got everything they need.
So tell us about the deal that at least was initially floated. You obtained a copy of at least his initial proposal, and that's the Mr. Bukuyan, and he's talking about, what is it, $5,000 to rent the arena per game, and then the city would pay him per person? How does that makes
it's
very
little bit,
sense.
It's a little bit of horse trading. It's certainly not a situation where somebody comes in here with a big wad of cash and says, hey, I want to move the team. So it's a little more complicated than that. And, you know, I have not seen every finer point of detail. The key for the city in this proposal is the revenues that it would get from parking and from, you know, food and beverage sales. So my understanding is that Celland Arena, there isn't a whole heck of a lot of that going on right now. So this would be kind of a new opportunity. Now, yes, I don't know how many people would go there and buy beer and hot dogs. I don't know how many people would pay $10 or how much it costs to park in the Celland Arena parking lot. So those are all kind of just projections. But, yes, that is kind of the deal, $5,000 per game, per rent, you know, he getting back money from the city, $3 per person. And that is, at least in the proposal, is to mitigate costs of things that Celland Arena can't give him, like a permanent home locker room, a training room, even a practice rink. You know, those are things I guess Celland isn't equipped for, and they'd have to rent and find other offices for that. So, again, it's a little bit of a complicated proposal. I would hope there's some negotiations back and forth. On the surface, it doesn't sound like an overwhelmingly great deal for Fresno, I have to say. But hopefully there's wiggle room in there. But again, people smarter than me and have more experience than me can run numbers and talk about projections.
Do you think the city and folks at City Hall are a little gun shy after the Falcons situation, and they don't want politically to be tied to another Falcons or another Grizzlies situation in that lease agreement that's been so complicated and so much in the media, dealing with the team's rent payment to the city and given the major cuts that have gone on at City Hall? There's a political angle to this story,
too.
No,
I believe so. I mean, I believe so, Joe. I think that, you know, I would like this hockey proposal to be judged on its own merits. If it makes sense for the city, go for it. If it doesn't, you know, deep six it. But unfortunately, I think the specter of the Falcons and all the money that was spent and kind of the ugliness that went on, and there's a big failed redevelopment plan for downtown that the Falcons were tied to. Remember the Legacy Project?
Yeah, the Legacy Project.
It was Alan Autry's great vision for his second term. All that stuff fell down the wayside. So, yes, I think it is a political hot potato a little bit, and it might be difficult for this proposal to be judged on its own merits.
Again, we're talking with Mark Warzowski of the Fresno Bee and also Mike Griffith, sports writer with the Bakersfield Californian. Mike, what does this ownership change for the Bakersfield Condors, now purchased by the Edmonton Oilers of the NHL? What does this mean? I know there's some talk about changing the name of the team to maybe something more related to the energy industry, which I guess would make sense. What does this mean in real terms for hockey fans in Bakersfield?
I think we just have to wait and see. The Oilers have much deeper pockets than Jonathan Fleisig, obviously. Daryl Cates is a billionaire and owns quite a few things, so they've got deep pockets. They're going to run it like a business, I would assume. They are pretty happy with the front office and the way they do things there, I understand, and don't want to change that because the Condors are quite known for a zany entertainment things, like the Condor getting loose and going out of hand and flying off, which they did not plan, but resulted in over 1 million views on YouTube. So they want to keep the front office having fun and making hockey games fun. And they'll run the hockey side as a business and maybe try to bring in undrafted players, mind them. But for what it means, I don't know. I mean, obviously the Oilers aren't very good on the NHL level. They haven't made the playoffs in 8 years, so they're trying to do everything they can to get better, I believe, and this will be a piece of the puzzle.
Mike, in just a few minutes before we go, you mentioned the situation at Sam Lynn Ballpark, and we're talking about minor league teams and the challenges cities face. The Bakersfield Blaze, the minor league baseball team that's in the city, last year there was a very ambitious plan, or the last 2 years has been an ambitious plan, to build a new privately financed stadium for the Blaze. That fell through. The ownership reverted back. What's the latest with the Blaze? Will there be minor league baseball, do you think, in Bakersfield after this year?
It's hard to say. I assume, there's colleagues been saying they're going to leave Bakersfield for 2 decades now because it's not a very good place to play, obviously. But until they have two teams, maybe in the Carolina, the other A-League team back east, they need two more teams to come in because they don't want to, like the ECHL had 9 teams with San Francisco, and it just makes a scheduling mess. They want an even number of teams. So unless there's two viable stadiums back east, or they move Bakersfield to somewhere like Stockton, which is maybe, a 10-year older, not Stockton, but Salinas or somewhere. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Until there's a new ballpark built somewhere, two of them, if they go back east or they move somewhere out west, I think they're here to stay, whether it's 1 year or 5 years. Who knows? But I know cities aren't building ballparks anymore.
Yeah, that's the new reality that we face, and I think many cities have learned the mistakes of past ambitious plans. Again, Mike Griffith, sports writer with the Bakersfield Californian, joining us today, and Mark Warzowski, sports columnist with the Fresno Bee, talking about the future of the business side of minor league hockey, minor league sports here in Central California. Thank you both for joining us today on Valley Edition.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and talk about how library officials in Tulare County are bringing books to communities without libraries thanks to vending machines. That's coming up next on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition.
In rural Tulare County, school libraries are small, and in many towns, public libraries are non-existent. While e-books and e-readers continue to be one of the hottest trends in education, these same small towns often struggle with the persistent digital divide between the haves and the have-nots. But as FM89's Ezra David Romero reports, officials with the Tulare County Library System are now using a different sort of technology to help improve literacy and help kids develop a lifelong love of reading.
Across a busy intersection from Cutler Elementary School in a gated park no bigger than a tract home is the Cutler Library. But this library is unlike most in Tulare County. It doesn't have doors or desks or even librarians. It's a vending machine.
I know which one I want, Captain Underpants.
Cutler is a community of 5,000 residents, about 30 miles southeast of Fresno. The machine is the first of four that the Tulare County Library System operates in the region. Jeff Scott is a county librarian.
These machines are really neat because they carry 300 books for the kids. They come up, they scan the library card, they press the number letter combination that they want, and they get their book. You can get M&Ms out of a candy machine, then you can get a book out of a library.
The machines are a mix between a vending machine and the popular Redbox units that dispense DVDs outside convenience stores and supermarkets. The library bought them 4 years ago with a $100,000 federal stimulus grant through the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And so we want to make sure the library is everywhere, so you don't have to drive 10 minutes to get to a library. If you don't have transportation, we want to put it right in your neighborhood.
Scott says that while iPads, Nooks, and other e-readers are popular nationwide, access to those technologies in rural Tulare County is often limited.
We look at a community like this, and we're not talking about technology or e-books. They don't have books at all.
He says the vending machines have been so successful that
the kids will empty the machine in one day. The Cutler machine, we've had it for about 3 or 4 years now, and we have to have someone come out twice a week to make sure the machine is replenished and it's in working order.
He attributes the success to the specific location of each machine.
The school is on one side. All the houses where they walk to are on the other side. That's kind of how we picked this location, was we kind of sat here and thought, well, what would be the best place for it? And then the school let out, and we saw all these people crossing this field, and they said, well, why don't we just put it right here?
The Tulare County Library will unveil their fifth book machine at Alta Vista Elementary School in East Porterville tomorrow, and they hope to install a sixth book machine in the near future.
We actually got a local private donation from a local grower who wants to put a book machine in his community. It gets so much traction, and we talk to people, and they see this concept. They get really excited. Everybody wants a machine in their community because that's the best and fastest way for us to provide library services to them.
And just like a normal library with a librarian, kids read the books, return them by sliding them into a Dropbox, and then have the opportunity to check out a few more.
I want the fairy one and
number.
For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
This is Valley Edition. California's ranchers depend on fall and winter rains to keep grasses growing for their livestock. But the state's drought is forcing them to make tough decisions. With rangelands dry statewide, moving herds isn't an option. Many are resorting to buying feed, but its rising cost is making that choice difficult. As Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento, some ranchers must decide whether to sell their livestock or go out of business.
Honestly, I am.
Jim Gates is talking to his hungry cows. The owner of Nevada County Free Range Beef pulls a bale of feed across a barn floor and loads it into his truck.
Well, this is Milo hay or gyp corn. Some people call it sorghum. It's not the best in the whole world, but it's a damn sight better than none.
Most years, his cows thrive on green grass that is fed by winter rains in the Sierra foothills. But Gates says this winter, if there's a blade of grass, he's trying to figure out how to put a cow on it to eat it.
Look at it out there. There ain't nothing for them to bite. They're wearing their teeth out trying to get at it.
We hop in his truck to feed some of his nearly 400 head of cattle. He says he's already had to feed more than 2 years' worth of hay.
They weren't billing at me because they think I'm a good guy. They're billing at me because this hay's on the back of the truck. This is going to affect the bottom line big time.
As we drive into his field with the feed, the cows come running.
Take it easy now.
Demand for hay has increased. So has its price. Finding it is another chore. Gates says most ranchers he's talked to have given up trying to feed their herd through the drought. Instead, they've sold their cattle.
They just took them to the auction and then they, you know, cut their herd in half. It's half the feed. Just like that. I don't have that option. The cattle you've seen already are already sold. This year, next year, the following year.
Come on, guys. Let's go out here.
Dan Macon owns 200 head of sheep. Several ewes would normally be grazing this time of year on his farm in Auburn. But the pasture is nothing but stubble. His pond is almost empty.
Normally by this time of year, our pond is full, too. So that's a pretty good indication of how dry it's been. And out here with this number of sheep, we'd have grass that was 3 or 4 inches high on a normal year.
Macon says this winter is the worst drought he's ever experienced, and it will likely be one of the most expensive. In normal years of rain and grass, he would budget about a pound of hay per ewe per day.
We try to keep 3 pounds per head per day going into the winter just in case we have a dry spell. And this year we're feeding about 6 pounds of hay per head per day, so double what we budgeted.
With no grass to hold down feeding costs, Macon says that leaves him with just one option.
We're going to have to sell 30 to 40% of those ewes just to bring our feed demand back in balance with the limited supply of grass this year. So, and that, I think, for every livestock producer that's having to sell animals, there's an emotional attachment that's really, we don't talk about it much, but that's one of the really hard parts about drought to me.
Macon says he'll make the decision at the end of the month, and if there's no rain, some of the animals in which he and his wife have invested 10 years will have to go to auction. To put the drought into some perspective, UC Sierra Foothill Research and Extension Center has measured the amount of grass it has grown over the last 30 years.
And what we saw this year really shocked us.
That's Jeremy James, the center's director. He says they've grown about 40 pounds of grass per acre.
What we normally would grow during that window between September and the end of December is about 500 pounds. So we're about 10 times lower on feed this year.
That's the lowest on record. James says ranchers are going to need more options than buying feed or selling their herd. The center is holding a conference this week to help ranchers survive the drought and stay in business. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
You're listening to Valley Edition. The main focus in the push to cover California's uninsured has thus far focused on individuals. But a program aimed at helping small businesses offer health care to their employees is being hailed by some as an important strategy. Rachel Dornhelm of California Healthline, a daily news service of the California Healthcare Foundation, reports.
Virginia Donahue is the owner of Pet Camp, a small business in San Francisco serving dog and cat owners.
Dog area and they're barking at you because you're a stranger.
We'll Pet Camp employs about 20 people. For 14 years, Donahue has been offering her employees health insurance. When the Affordable Care Act became law, it not only mandated an individual health insurance market, it also required that small employers have a marketplace specially tailored for them if they wanted to provide their workers with coverage. The Small Business Health Options Program, or SHOP Exchange, was created. Donahue was named to a special advisory group that helped shape California's SHOP Exchange. She says for a small business owner, continuity and ease of use were top priorities.
We wanted something where we could still continue to use our agents if we wanted to, but for those people who don't have agents, you know, they can just shop online directly.
Donahue says she is able to use her long-term agent as she chooses whether to renew her existing employee plan or switch to one offered through SHOP. Donahue says one way the government is trying to incentivize people to use SHOP is by offering a tax credit.
Right now, it looks like SHOP is a little bit less expensive, and I get the tax credit. So that would be pretty significant.
Donahue says another important option with SHOP is that her employees would get a choice of insurers. Right now, she only offers Kaiser. David Chase is the California director of the Small Business Majority. He says employers would pick a tier of coverage and then employees could select from there.
Employees will be able to pick their own carrier, which is something that's historically been difficult or in many cases just impossible for employers to offer their employees a choice of plans in the small business. That's now really being brought to the small group market for the first time.
Chase says SHOP represents a number of firsts. It levels the pricing playing field. In the past, small businesses have paid about 18% more than large businesses for coverage. And he says, with the federal program delayed a year, California's SHOP Exchange offers small employers unique web functionality.
We've got our online system up and running where it's not in those in the states that are running on the federal system. We have the employee choice function not available in the federally facilitated exchanges. So we're really seeing, you know, those states really looking at California and seeing here's what a SHOP program looks like, sort of the way it was intended.
Why the special effort to build a special portal just for small businesses? Congressman Ami Bera from Sacramento County says companies with fewer than 50 employees are one of the linchpins of extending health care coverage, even though those employers are not actually required to provide insurance.
If you look at the folks that are uninsured in America, 80% of them are attached to the workforce. Either they're working or someone in their family is working. And the vast majority of those individuals work in small businesses, businesses that are 1 to 50 employees. That's why we really have to work with these small businesses.
Barra says it will be interesting to take stock of the program at the end of the first year to see how successful it has been.
There'll be this 1 year of implementation, and you'll have to get a sense how many of the small businesses, given the tax incentives, are now choosing to provide health insurance benefits to their employees. And what does this look like?
So far, at least 1,500 small employers have registered with the site. Covered California spokesperson Ann Gonzalez says even though the program is completely voluntary, employers may discover perks.
Business owners that want to offer this as either a recruiting and retention tool, or they want to use it to keep their employees healthy and because they know it's a good thing to do.
Initial figures released in late January show that 289 businesses have signed up for the SHOP program so far, covering 2,100 employees. But Gonzalez says enrollments are expected to continue throughout 2014 as employers' plans come up for renewal, so any conclusions about the program will have to wait until next year. That was Rachel Dornhelm reporting for California Healthline, a daily news service of the California Healthcare Foundation. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Taxpayers have already bailed out banks during the past several years, and now one of them wants to get bailed out again. In this edition of Valley Public Radio's commentary series, The Moral Is, Ida Jones, professor of business law at Fresno State, argues that taxpayers should not have to continue to bail out financial institutions that speculated in mortgage securities and then lost when the real estate market collapsed.
Just when you thought it was safe to come out of the water because taxpayers had finished bailing out financial institutions that lost money gambling on mortgage securities, along comes J.P. Morgan to ask for more money. In 2008, J.P. Morgan purchased the federally insured bank, Washington Mutual, or WAMU, for $1.9 billion. That was $7 billion less than it had originally offered. It got such a great deal because the FDIC supported the move. J.P. Morgan would take over WAMU's assets, along with its massive mortgage debts, and the FDIC had one less bank to liquidate. Problem solved, right? Not so fast, though. A few weeks ago, J.P. Morgan sued the FDIC, arguing that J.P. Morgan didn't really mean to take on all of WAMU's mortgage liabilities. In its lawsuit, J.P. Morgan now claims that it agreed to take on only a small amount of WAMU's liability and that the FDIC has to pay for the remainder. Coincidentally, this lawsuit was filed approximately 6 months after J.P. Morgan agreed to a $13 billion settlement of a lawsuit the government had brought against it for its misconduct in the mortgage market. In the current lawsuit, J.P. Morgan doesn't state an amount it wants from the FDIC, or in other words, from the taxpayers, and eventually a judge will have to decide who should win. But we already know who will lose. Who will pay for the lawsuit costs? Who will provide funds if the remaining WaMu receivership funds are not enough? The taxpayers, of course. There's something wrong with this system when taxpayers, many of whom lost their homes, have to continue to support banks whose gambles in the mortgage market didn't pay off. Taxpayers, some who have gingerly begun dipping their toes into the housing market, may want to stay out of the water a little bit longer. For The Moral Is, this is Ida Jones.
You're listening to Valley Edition. 2014 marks the 75th anniversary of the publication of John Steinbeck's tale of the Dust Bowl emigration to California, The Grapes of Wrath. Late last year, Cal State Bakersfield launched a year-long celebration of the book and its author, which includes an event taking place tomorrow night at CSUB titled If Steinbeck Was a Farmer. The event will feature a talk led by award-winning author and organic farmer David Moss Masumoto, who joins us now in our studio. Moss, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're also joined on the phone by Jackie Kegley from CSUB.
Thank you.
Welcome.
And I'm with the Kegley Institute of Ethics, so it's a pleasure to be here also.
Moss, I'll start with you. You're giving a talk. Are you talking about the book? What do you hope to touch upon?
It's not directly talking about Grapes of Wrath, but certainly it talks about some of the themes and issues that Steinbeck brought up. In thinking about how I wanted to present this, I thought, what if we reframed it slightly, especially using my perspective as a farmer? So that's why the talk is entitled, If Steinbeck Were a Farmer. And it's the idea that looking at some of the themes that he brought up and often wrote about, not only in Grapes of Wrath, but in things such as Of Mice and Men, themes of injustice, inequality, struggle, and especially looking at Grapes of Wrath and the issue of the natural environment, specifically the drought that's led to that migration of displaced farmers from Oklahoma to California. I think it's appropriate because we're going through this drought in California too.
Turning to you, Jackie, this book was published 75 years ago, but the issues that Steinbeck talks about, as Moss so eloquently stated just a moment ago, are still very relevant to this day. Do you think that's part of the enduring appeal of Steinbeck? Obviously, it has a local focus for those of us here in the Central Valley that will remain and endure. But what do you think makes this book resonate still today?
Well, I think Moss is absolutely right. It's that it deals with themes of inequality and justice and misplacement, the moving of people from their land that they had dedicated their lives to, and therefore they are wandering and lost, and the natural environment. He's absolutely right. Drought is with us again, so these are issues we're facing again. So it's the universal issues, really, that makes this book so powerful.
Moss, turning back to you, the title of this event, If Steinbeck Was a Farmer, you're familiar with his work, certainly. And Steinbeck was a great author and brought a certain sensibility to all of his works. You're a farmer. You deal with the triumph and the tragedy of being out in the fields every day and have written so eloquently about these things. As a writer yourself and as a farmer, do you feel any kinship with Steinbeck, and what do you think his experience might lend itself to this discussion of the relationship between agriculture and writing.
Steinbeck's amazing author, especially if you're a Californian, because so many of his stories, and so much, especially Grapes of Wrath, it took place in California. It's part of the California story. And certainly as a farmer growing up on a family farm, you always sense that some of those tales were around you, and they were, because you understand the notion of migration of patterns. You find the Okies that were parts of many of our communities, especially here in the Valley. And as a writer, what always struck me about Steinbeck is you're reading his works of fiction, his novel, Grapes of Wrath, and you realize, though, writers do great research, and he did. He came to visit the Valley many times and to get the firsthand look at what he saw. Simultaneously, I would look at other things such as Dorothea Lange's photos of the Great Depression, and you see these people and their struggle, and yet at the same time their sense of trying to find some kind of dignity in their life that they did. That's the balance that I was always struck by Steinbeck. And it's the same type of theme that I try to explore in my own writing and in the talk that I'll be delivering on Wednesday evening.
And now, Jackie, turning to you with this talk about Steinbeck's legacy and how it relates to us today. You're approaching this from the Kegley Institute of Ethics. You have brought in some great speakers over the year talking about some really big ethical dilemmas. The Kenneth Feinberg speech was amazing, and many others as well. How are you approaching this topic from looking at it from philosophy, from ethics, from that vantage point? What do you think we can gain from that perspective?
Well, it's the focus again on the inequalities and the injustices that tend to still exist in our society, though we tend to forget them. And I think what Steinbeck and Moss reminds us in his beautiful books is that this legacy is still with us, and there are still people out there struggling to survive and also trying to maintain some kind of sense of human dignity. And this is what ethics is all about, the value of human beings, their ability to find dignity in life and be respected. And this was certainly true of the Okies who came across and the disrespect and the discrimination they faced, and yet they struggled on and established themselves and have become members of our community. And so this is our legacy, not only of California, but of the whole country.
Moss, if Steinbeck was with us today, a resident of our contemporary society, and saw the issues that we face today, from income inequality to stories about how many communities that are largely populated by farm-working immigrants here in the Central Valley, where the people who pick the food can't afford to actually eat the food that they pick, as Sasha Coca of KQED's California Report recently profiled on NPR nationally, these food deserts that we have here in the Valley. What do you think that Steinbeck would remark about our current situation? Do you think he would be surprised that we haven't made more progress in the last 75 years? These issues are still there?
I think Steinbeck would look at the issue and he'd be faced with a difficult decision. Does he write as a journalist, or does he write in the genre of fiction and novels? Because each has their own power to sort of capture what he sees in the world today. I think he'd be torn by the fact that progress in many ways hasn't been achieved, and yet at the same time there have been types of progress. I mean, life expectancy has increased, the level of health care has increased, there's access to education, there's more opportunity, and at the same time the novelist in him, I think, would be shook by that fact that things haven't changed, and there's that struggle, that eternal struggle within humans that are still capturing the themes that he always tried to work with. You know, I think of his book of Mice and Men, and looking at those similar themes of trying to have the dignity of someone and yet the harsh reality that we all live in. I think that would be one of the struggles. I would be curious how he would look at the role of women today and the role of ethnic and cultural communities. Grapes of Wrath was largely written from a white viewpoint, and most of the main characters were men. Certainly there is a few characters, the strong mother in it. But today's world, I'd be curious to see how he'd examine those kind of issues and work the magic that he did.
Jackie, one of the other things that I find very interesting, and is all throughout Central California, if you look at how the Grapes of Wrath is received today versus how it was received when it was first published, the attitudes have changed significantly. What do you think that says about our society when at the same time we're still dealing with some of these issues? The faces, maybe the skin color, the nationality has changed of those who are doing the work in the fields, the immigrants who are coming here for a better life. Yet at the same time, our attitudes about the book, where in some cases it was not well received at all when it was first published, when the movie came out and things here in the Valley, but today it's celebrated. How do you remark on that dichotomy there?
Well, I think Moss hit the nail on the head in a sense when he talked about it as being fiction, and I think he's absolutely right. If Steinbeck were coming back today, we wonder, yes, this novel is now pretty well received as a great novel, and it's seen in its human element. But I wonder if it were written from the viewpoint of an ethnic group or from a different women, if it would be as well received. I think probably it would, but it would be a wonderful experiment to rewrite the Grapes of Wrath from a different viewpoint. And I think one of the wonderful things that Moss has done is bring a new story, a new viewpoint to this whole story, and that's why it's great that he's coming and talking about this. If Steinbeck was a farmer, because he's bringing this new kind of experience to the story.
I always was curious, if Steinbeck were alive today and working on the modern-day Grapes of Wrath, what form would he do that? Would it be an investigative journalist piece? Would it become a documentary? Would it become a reality TV show? I mean, there's just these fascinating ways to look at that. And the irony is, possibly the most powerful venue was that it would become a reality TV show. I mean, if Duck Dynasty could have millions of people watching it, imagine this kind of show. What do you think, Jackie? What would be the genre?
I don't know. I assume, yes, that's the media we're dealing with. I want to hold out for the wonderful value of storytelling, which you do so well. I think that captures almost everybody that can sit down and read a story and be engaged in it. I think the reality shows become more entertainment than they do capture our value system. They do to a certain extent, but nothing like a good novel or a good story that gets us involved in it and we identify with it and begin to see the struggle and the human dignity in that. I just don't know. It's a good question. But
it certainly is. I could definitely imagine Steinbeck on Twitter or Instagram or the like documenting.
Well, it would be fascinating if you could read his blog as he did his research for Grapes of Wrath. You know?
Now, that's, yes.
Well, I mean, wouldn't you like to see his notes that he took and when he you know, as he is formulating these ideas and as he's, you know, developing these characters? I would love to have seen all that as it developed and everything.
Well, it's a fascinating story and it's a fascinating idea to consider, and I'm sure there will be a lot of ideas discussed tomorrow night at the CSUB Multipurpose Room. Again, the event is called If Steinbeck Was a Farmer. It's presented by the CSUB Kegley Institute of Ethics, and it features our guest today, David Moss Masumoto, acclaimed farmer and author, who joins us today on Valley Edition. He'll be giving the keynote talk, and it'll be followed by a discussion of local experts featuring Jill Eglund, Director of Community Development with the United Way of Kern County, Aaron Hedge, Director of CSUB's Environmental Resource Management Program, and Fatima Hernandez with the UFW Foundation. Again, we've been talking with Jackie Kegley, professor with the CSUB Kegley Institute of Ethics. Jackie, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And David Moss Masumoto, thank you again.
Oh, Joe, it's always been a pleasure, and I can't wait for the KVPR Duck Dynasty version. So.
And on that note, that's another Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The program is produced by Ezra David Romero, along with reporter Rebecca Plevin, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver.
You can reach us online. Our email address is talk@kvpr.org. You can also tweet us @KVPR and find us on Facebook at Valley Public Radio. This is Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care.
Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.